Thanks. Thanks, Roger. So thanks, by the way, to everybody, and especially to KATP for making this program and workshop possible. So as the title says, I want to show you some results about how to apply reinforcement learning to quantum control. So how do we control systems, quantum systems, away from equilibrium. There are two papers related to what I'm going to present today. So the first one was done with collaboration in collaboration with all these guys at BU. And the second one, I basically took some ideas. And when I moved to Berkeley, I continued working on this. So it kind of all fits nicely together. Well, what is reinforcement learning, and how does it fit within the machine learning paradigm? Throughout the program, we have heard about supervised learning. In supervised learning, one is given a set of labeled data, and the task or the goal is to find an approximate model or an approximate function which generalizes beyond the known data. So this was explained yesterday by Giuseppe. There is also unsupervised learning, and in unsupervised learning, we are no longer given labels to the data, so the data is now unlabeled, and the goal is to find an approximate probability distribution which generated the data. So in unsupervised learning, we want to find a probability distribution instead of a function. And reinforcement learning is kind of different than these two paradigms in the sense that in reinforcement learning, you have an agent which learns how to optimize, how to perform a given task by interacting with its environment. So the way that works is there's an agent. The agent has to make a decision to choose an action, and the action is going to do something to its environment. In such a way that the environment is going to change. Once the environment changes, there will be a reward given back to the agent. And so this feedback loop is stimulating the agent, so to speak, to learn from its mistake. So the interaction with the environment is what is distinguishing reinforcement learning from the other two paradigms. But it's also another thing which is different, rather, in the case of supervised learning compared to unsupervised learning, that the probability distribution which generates the learning data changes in time due to the interaction with the environment. So the agent kind of biases this probability that generates the data. Now, of course, that said, you can find for sure many similarities between reinforcement learning, unsupervised learning, and supervised learning, and this is why it's all under the same hood of ML. So the boundaries between these three are not really sharp, but they're sharp enough so we can speak of them as different branches. Different subfields of ML. Now, here are some examples of reinforcement learning. First, let's start with examples outside physics. Yesterday, Giuseppe mentioned the papers by DeepMind, which trained a reinforcement learning agent, a deep reinforcement learning agent, to play video games, these Atari games, board games, where the agent was eventually able to defeat the human champion. But also, subsequently, there were papers showing how RL can be used for locomotion tasks. So this is all kind of outside of physics. But recently, in the last couple of years, RL started picking up in physics as well. So to the left, there is a very nice work by Gautam Reddy, where they showed that it is possible to teach an RL agent to figure out how to navigate thermal currents in the atmosphere. And they actually had a real experimental model, like a small plane, to prove the results experimentally. Then this is an application of using RL to navigate through turbulent currents. So it's actually, you know, turbulence is a phenomenon that is known to be extremely hard, and it's not clear if it's possible to navigate through these chaotic fluids. So it turns out that this is possible by an Italian group in Rome. And this is an example of something that I'm going to talk about today, which is called quantum control. So we're going to use reinforcement learning to steer quantum systems into desired states. But I should say that when it comes to quantum systems, there's other applications. For example, there's design of molecular properties, there's design of quantum optics experiments, and even there's error correction studies, and so forth. So reinforcement learning is slowly picking up speed in physics as well. So in this talk, I'm going to show you two examples. The first example is how to use RL to steer a many-body system from a given initial state to a given target state. And I hope to be able to have time to talk about some variational theories that are inspired, some variational theories for these optimal control protocols, which are inspired by the solutions found by the agent. And in the second part of the talk, we'll take a system that is intrinsically out of equilibrium even without controlling it, and then we're going to try to control it on top of strong periodic drives. So we have it's going to be like a simple quantum oscillator, but such that the dynamics of it is not easy to solve. So we're going to get to that. I'm going to explain some of the details. Okay, so let's dive into the first example right away. So I'm going to use the first example to introduce first what I want to do in terms of quantum control, and then I'm going to explain a little bit about more about what reinforcement learning is and which kind of reinforcement learning algorithms we use. And then from there, we're going to go to the next example. So the idea here is to take a closed chain of spins, of qubits, if you wish. The qubits are interacting via nearest neighbors. I put the system in a constant field along the z-axis. And then there is a time-dependent field along the x-axis. So this model is actually a complicated model in quantum dynamics, in the study of quantum dynamical systems, because this is a quantum chaotic model. What this means is that if you're not careful about how actually you perturb the system with this time-dependent field, because of quantum chaos, this system might start absorbing energy, and entropy will be created, so it's going to become hopeless beyond a certain point. So it is a non-trivial task to control these kind of many-body systems. So what do we want to do with the system? We take the system in an initial state, psi I, which we take to be a paramagnetic ground state of that chain if I choose the parameters hz plus 1 and hx negative 2. And then what I want is I want to find a functional form for this external field along the x direction such that in the end of a given period of time, my system evolves into the state psi star, which is the target state, which is also the ground state, but for hx equals positive 2. So that's what we want to do. Now, of course, there's infinitely many functions that you can try to search from, you know, to find the best one. And in particular, just for numerical simplicity, I would like to specialize on the so-called bang-bang protocol. So these are protocols as a function of time. So this is the protocol as a function of time, which only take two values on the boundary of the allowed domain, that is one positive and one negative value. And these values are going to be negative and positive 4. And these numbers are basically chosen in such a way that that the problem is not immediately trivial. So you see, I can only, like, my control can only take values between positive and negative 4, yet I would like to prepare a state which lives at plus 2. Okay? And then this bang-bang structure means that I'm looking for a protocol that is taking values only, as I said, on the boundary, and then eventually in a fixed amount of time, fixed amount of time, TF, reaches the target state. So how does such a protocol look like, if you wish? So this is now as a discretized as a function of time. It can take only values plus and minus 4. Okay. The important thing is that the number of banks is fixed because I'm fixing the total duration of the protocol. So that's important to note here. Okay. So how do we? So this is the problem now, and the question is how do we phrase the problem? How do we formulate it within the RL framework? So once again, in RL, we have an agent. The agent has to choose actions, so we have to define what these actions are to control an environment. We're going to define what the environment is. And as a result, the environment is going to change its state. We're going to define the states of the environment and also the reward function that gets back to the agent. So how does it look in practice, or more concretely? So the action space, so the agent, what the agent will be doing is the agent will be constructing these bang-bang sequences one pulse at a time. So the action space consists of the two possible values for the control protocol, which are positive and negative 4. Now, to choose the state space, reinforcement learning requires that the reinforcement learning states completely characterize the environment. Now, the environment is going to be our physical system, because this is what we would like to control. But there is an intrinsic subtlety here. That is, the physical system, the properties of the physical system, because it's quantum, are uniquely encoded in the quantum state. But the quantum state is a mathematical construct. It's not an observable. You cannot really measure the quantum state. You cannot see it. So even though we know that we want to be able to model all the states accessible during the dynamics, we cannot do this. So the way out here, and this is specific to quantum systems and quantum control, is to realize that any evolved state, given that the initial state is fixed, is the set of all possible states that can be that can be reached within Schrödinger time evolution from a given initial state is the same thing, or almost the same thing, so this is not strict equality, but it's kind of almost the same thing, as the set of all protocols and fixing the initial state. That is to say, if I fix the initial state, and I know that Schrödinger's evolution is deterministic, then I know what state my system ought to be in after I apply a given protocol sequence, without actually knowing, without actually measuring the state. So this is kind of the idea here. And once again, this is not an equality between these two sets, but it's good enough for our purposes. It kind of takes into account this problem of not being able to measure the state. I should say that another way, hopefully like in the future, are kind of the works of Giacomo and, yeah, right, I guess, and Juan, where one can do tomography. If you can do tomography, then you can probably know what your state is ahead of time. I guess Roger is also part of the gang there. Okay, so the states, the reinforcement learning states, are going to be all possible strings of these combinations plus and minus 4. So for example, this is one possible state. I'm going to show you more examples on the next slide. The last thing we need, the last ingredient, is the reward. So since I want to prepare a given state, then it's natural to look at the overlap between the target state and the state that my system is in after some time, capital T. And the reward space consists of the so-called fidelities. So what my agent will be doing is the agent will be increasing, will be optimizing, maximizing the fidelity. Any questions so far? Okay. So what is RL in a nutshell? So RL can be viewed as a Markov decision process for the reinforcement learning agent. So suppose that we start from some state ST. From that state, the agent can take an action out of this with certain probability that depends on the state. Once the action has been chosen, then conditioned on the state that you're in and the action, the environment will transition into another state with another probability distribution. So these are called transition probabilities. This is called the policy. And upon this transition, the agent is given a reward. And the reward can be estimated from the reward function, which is essentially, yeah, I'm going to show you more completely what it is, but it's estimated by the transition probabilities to get in a given state and the reward of the state that you end up in. And from the next state, the agent has to now pick a new action, right? It's going to, picking new action is going to move the environment into the next possible state and so forth until one reaches the final state. So one has a sequential Markov decision process, and in that case, it's going to be a finite Markov decision process. And the idea is to optimize the final reward that the agent gets. So the RL objective is to maximize the total expected return from a given step T onwards until the end of the episode. And this total expected return has a name, and it's called the Q function. It's essentially what's written here. So if you wish, the Q function from state S and taking action A is the expected return in the end following a given policy. Yes?
But the transition probability is not known.
The transition probability is not known.
So how do you compute the reward?
Right. So in principle, in reinforcement learning, you have two options to use these algorithms. One is in a simulator, and the other one is in the real world. If you want to use this in the real world, then your world has the transition probability built in. If you want to use a simulator, then you need a model for these transition probabilities, and this is where all the complications are going to be hidden. Now, that said, there is a formulation of reinforcement learning, part of which is the algorithm that we are using, which is called dynamic programming. And in dynamic programming, one can formulate a self-consistent equation for the Q function in such a way that the Q function at a given time step is related to the Q function of the future time steps. And in that case, one avoids using transition probabilities. So one can massage the equations in a way. This is, it's something on a slide, but I think I should better, you know, like get to the physics of it. But we can, like, you can ask maybe afterwards, and I can show you exactly what it was, but what it is. But the basic idea is that it's true. This guy is not known. But with that definition, I can essentially derive a self-consistent equation for Q, and I can solve it iteratively without knowing what the transition probabilities are. Now, that said, I want to say right away, just before I come to Juan's question, that for quantum control, sometimes these guys are deterministic. That is to say, you know, if my agents decide to take a given action, then this action is taken. Right? Which doesn't have to be always the case. I'm going to show you an example where it's not the case.
So I understand, like, the setting and why you want to use reinforcement learning. But, like, couldn't you use, like, kind of like annealing, like, on the R?
Absolutely. Yes and no. Using annealing on R,
kind of maximizing R with respect to this next speed.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. This you can do. Yes. So there are particular, yes. So for example, if you want to do, say, something like zero temperature Monte Carlo, or maybe something like with some temperature, so that you anneal. Yes. You can apply these methods here. That's true. Yes. So actually, I have another slide about the relation between reinforcement learning and optimal control kind of techniques when we come to it.
Maybe a question, but yes. Maybe I should have asked earlier. But so, is the goal here to understand the quantum control? I mean, wouldn't a setting like that be also interesting in controlling a classical system?
So you are completely right that I can use as a reward function anything I'd like, and there's enough classical systems that are not understood, especially away from equilibrium. So yes, one can use the same setting for a classical system. In a classical system, however, there is no requirement. In a classical system, I can measure my observables. So I have a notion of state. For example, if I have a simple pendulum, then I know what's the momentum of it, and I know what's the position of it, what's the angle. So I can also use these variables instead of these sequences. Yes, and it's possible. Okay. So how does that work in practice? How does the agent construct these protocols? So once again, there's the agent, and as I said, there's the environment. Now, in our case, the environment consists of the initial value problem, that is, of the Hamiltonian, which contains the uncontrolled system and the control term, and the initial state, together with Schrödinger's equation and the time interval. And additionally, into the environment, we also have the target state, so that the agent can get information how far it is from the target state. Now, the reward here for quantum control contains other peculiarities related to quantum systems, which would not be there for classical systems. And one of these peculiarities is that if I have a quantum state, then I can, in order to measure which state I'm in, which I need to get my fidelity, then I'm going to collapse the state. And once the state is collapsed, then it's basically game over. What this means is that I can only measure the state once. That is to say, throughout the entire sequence, my agent is not receiving any reward, except at the very final time. And in the final time, it receives the fidelity of being in the target state. Okay? So this is another constraint. So how does the agent now construct protocols? So here what I'm showing is I'm showing such a bang-bang protocol from time zero on the x-axis to this horizon, which is the final time. And the first thing I do is I chop time into equal pieces of equal steps. And then the idea for the agent would be to take these actions plus or minus 4 and then decide to construct the bang-bang sequence. So let us assume that the agent starts from the reinforcement learning state, which is negative 4 down here. First thing that the agent does is it takes an action. Let's say that this is positive 4. And then the environment transitions into the state minus 4, positive 4. So this state defines a protocol. And if my initial state is fixed, then this also fixes the instantaneous state of my system, of the instantaneous quantum state of my system. Okay. So then I solve Schrödinger equation to that, corresponding to this piece of protocol. And I can compute from it my reward. I look up the table, and the reward is 0. Then I update my Q function according to that reward. Then I repeat the same process, and I get to another state. And then the whole process continues until I exhaust all time steps in the sequence. And in the very last step, Of course, the agent receives the reward. Now, that whole sequence is called one episode or one epoch. Usually in reinforcement learning, the term is episode. And the idea of reinforcement learning is now to use this information and in repeated attempts to kind of play this game to find the optimal sequence of protocols. And optimal with respect to the reward, with respect to the fidelity. So that's the basic idea here. You can almost anticipate one problem here. And the problem is that the state space, the space of all protocol sequences, is exponentially large. And in particular, if I have two actions, right, and I have nt steps, then I have 2 to the power nt possible configurations from which I have to find the optimal one. So we have exponentially many configurations, and we're looking for the one which maximizes the fidelity. And the natural question that one can ask is, can we estimate the values of not yet encountered states? That is to say, do I know the fidelity that corresponds to not yet encountered protocols? And yes, there is one way of doing this. For example, by parameterizing the cube function, this object that I'm trying to learn, that contains the expected reward, at the end of the protocol by, for example, a deep neural network. Like one way, a typical approach is to use a deep neural network. Another approach would be to use a linear function approximator. Actually, in the simulation that I'm going to show you next, in the next slide, we don't use a deep neural network, but a linear functional approximation. And the reason for this is that in RL, typically the Q-learning algorithm has convergence guarantees only for linear function approximators. That is to say, if I use a neural network because it's a nonlinear function, then this algorithm doesn't necessarily converge. It might converge, but it may not. And there's also a whole bunch of other empirical tricks that one needs to use to make this functional approximation work. And just to flash some examples about deep RL. So I looked at Dries' talk like from 2 weeks ago, so I think he discussed most of them, but just to refresh your memory. So that's Thesaurus Backgammon Player. So this is an RL agent that learned how to play backgammon in 1992 using a deep neural network. This was by the time that, I don't know, it was like 3 years after I was born, so I certainly didn't know about deep neural networks at the time. I don't know about you. Then I mentioned the Atari games and the AlphaGo, but then also there's like more kind of there's applications that are more relevant to real life, like for example, safe driving cars, autonomous drones or helicopters, hovering and so forth. So all of this can be done with the same Q-learning algorithm. Okay, so now I want to show you the process of learning how to prepare the quantum state for the quantum problem that I defined. Now, in order to show you the process of learning, I want to show you a video. And showing you a video is a little bit challenging when you have a many-body quantum system. So first of all, I should say that the system that we simulate has on the order of 10 qubits. But this is almost the best you could do with non-integrable Ising models nowadays without quantum computers. And in order to show you, in order to visualize the dynamics of that system, I'm going to use the following trick. So because I put my system on a closed ring and I use periodic boundary conditions, due to translation invariance, if you wish, all these spins or the expectation values of the spin operators on all these sites have the same expectation value because of translation invariance. Whatever happens on site one is going to happen in site two and so forth. So what this means is that I can trace over all these spins, and it doesn't matter which ones I trace over, and I'm going to left with a single one. And for this single one, I can compute the reduced density matrix, and I can visualize this object on the Bloch sphere. So here is a Bloch sphere with the reduced density matrix. You see in green the initial state, and you see in red the target state. So the agent starts here, and the agent wants to get to the target state. Other quantities that I'm showing is, so this is the reward, so this is the fidelity at the end of the episode for every given episode that we're going to be training over. And just in case you're curious, here's the entanglement of the leftover qubit and the instantaneous fidelity. Now, the instantaneous fidelity is not used for training, only the final fidelity is used. And the other thing I should say is that because we have a many-body system, instead of looking at the fidelity itself, it turns out that there is a quantity which remains finite in the thermodynamic limit for this problem, and this is the log fidelity, the normalized log fidelity. Okay. I wonder if I'm forgetting to mention something, but yeah, and the black dots are just a guide to the eye, so they are related to a protocol which I'm going to show you on one of the next slides, which we were able to get to by using ideas from the solution from the agent. So you see in the and I should say that whenever you see that this color is becoming dimmer or that the pointer is getting into the sphere, then it means that the state actually gets more and more entangled. So you see, in the beginning, the agent is taking random actions because it has zero knowledge about the quantum system. It knows nothing about it. And after something like 40 episodes, it gets to 90% fidelity. However, you can see how it is still entangling the state in the end. So there's still some residual entanglement, and because the initial and the target, in particular the target states, are ground states, they have area low entanglement. And because of this, you expect that the optimal protocol, even if it creates some entanglement during the evolution, it will actually have to take it away beforehand. So what we see is that after a 1200 episodes, we have something on the order of 98-99% fidelity. And in fact, if you keep running this algorithm for longer and longer, it will actually converge to a local minimum of this fidelity landscape. So it's guaranteed to get to some local minimum, but we don't know if it finds the global one, as is often the case in practice.
And what would you mean guaranteed?
There are no guarantees to find
a
global
minimum. There are no guarantees.
Yes. I'm sorry if I said it there. No, there are no guarantees. In fact, we showed, but I don't have time to discuss this today, we showed that the complexity of preparing the state can be extremely high. Like there are some analogies with glassy landscapes, and I know that this says something to people in the audience. So it's intrinsically hard to find the optimal protocol configuration for this problem. Karen?
I think of this as a quantum control problem. So your target functional is this overlap between
yes.
the target wave function and the initial wave function. But why isn't it something simpler, like, you know, just one or two variable overlap, like a correlation function?
You could, in principle, put whatever you like. If you're making a point that the fidelity is not the most meaningful observable for many body systems, it's in fact not even an observable, I completely agree with that point. So in principle, one could measure one could measure observables there. That's not the problem.
So why did you pick?
Well, we picked the fidelity because for this particular problem, we were able to show that quantity has a well-defined thermodynamic limit. That is to say, you can actually, it becomes finite as the number of qubits increases, and the important thing of having the fidelity, using the fidelity as compared to some observable, is that if I prepare one observable, I don't have to prepare the state. The agent doesn't have to really prepare the exact state.
Right.
So you know, you might be able to do one observable, but not another. Whereas if you prepare the state, you can do all observables. So that's kind of it, but in principle you can do In principle you can play with different cost functions. Andre.
So maybe, can you reiterate the motivation of using reinforcement learning? I mean, for example, for these particular examples, right, I could think of just solving an optimization problem.
Right.
Especially with like binary variables that tell me when I like branch.
Right. So you're asking when to use reinforcement learning compared to, say, some optimal control.
Yes. For example, for this problem, you could like without learning, right, just solve optimization problem, it would be probably faster. So could you just...
So we did solve it without... Okay, yes. Can I deflect your question for a couple of slides? Like, I have a comment exactly on optimal control and reinforcement learning and how they hang together. And in the second example, I think I'm going to introduce a little bit more noise. And then, I guess, the optimization algorithms are going to have a little bit more trouble. So just to give you a brief answer, reinforcement learning is most useful when you don't have a model for your environment. So for example, here I have an intrinsic model because I'm simulating the whole dynamics, right? This is, I guess, what you're saying. But suppose that, you know, I wanted to do this in an experiment, and in an experiment I have a guess of what the Hamiltonian might be, but there might be some, you know, additional terms there, there might be some external fields that I don't know how to take into account. Then you can use that, because then you don't have the exact model.
But you suppose a model for your Hamiltonian though, right? So it's a well-defined problem. I mean, I solve Schrödinger equation, I get my state, and then
you mean
my function is to compute overlap in the end.
Right.
So
I mean, so you have some model, right? In principle, you can just set up an optimization for this model.
Right.
That's my. But if you will comment on this later.
I will comment on this later. But I'm saying, just to answer your question, that you don't need a model. And this is really the advantage of reinforcement learning. Because for this particular spin chain, I can write a model. But for a more complicated material, I can no longer write the exact model, right? And then you need something that is able to generalize beyond. Okay. That's kind of the idea. But I'll comment on optimal control and reinforcement learning and how they relate to each other later. Because it's a valid remark. Okay, so why do we want to use reinforcement learning in non-equilibrium dynamics specifically, now that I've shown you that you can? Well, the idea is that the reinforcement learning has kind of three advantages. One is that it is model-free, so coming back to the question. The second one is that it's adaptive. And the third one is that it's actually autonomous. That is, it doesn't require any supervision. So the model-free part, what this means is that the agent is capable of finding effective control degrees of freedom. Now, this is something that is actually extremely powerful because, for example, if you want to pour a beer into a glass, right, then you are able to write down all 10 to the 23 Hamilton's equations or Newton's equations for this problem, but then probably you won't get too far away by solving all these a huge number of microscopic level and microscopic equations. Whereas we do know, just from common sense, that there are a few effective degrees of freedom which can do the task. And then reinforcement learning is supposed to find such effective degrees of freedom. Now, for classical systems, we have common sense, so we can also guess what these effective degrees of freedom are. But for quantum antibody systems, it's not, I mean, at least I don't know of any guiding principles that tell us what is the macroscopic behavior of a quantum system. So this is where I think that reinforcement learning can offer an advantage. The second, yes. Okay, I guess I mentioned, I mentioned this. Now the second thing is that it's adaptive. That is to say, we can train the agent on one environment and then you can test it on another environment, which is similar. So if you kind of have some gut feeling that the two environments might have something in common, then you can do like this, what's called like transfer learning. So this is, or might reveal similarities between at first sight unrelated problems. And yes, and the autonomous aspect of RL, I think, might be important, especially in experiments where you don't really need the graduate student to sit down and tune the knob for 2 weeks. You might be able to just automate the entire process and have a smart algorithm to basically prepare your state for you or do something else to your quantum system. Okay, so going back to our spin chain, there were like these dots on the block sphere, and I want to briefly show you how one can use the solutions that somebody has given us, in that case the reinforcement learning algorithm, to construct some variational theories about how to control this many-body system for this particular problem. So if you look at the optimal solution optimal solution where the duration goes up to 1.0, this is in units of j, then you see a structure like that. So initially the agent decides to stay for quite some time, then there's a sequence of symmetric bands, and then it becomes to stay at the negative site of the protocol. So if you look at it, you might say, well, let me try to mimic this behavior. So if I have a lot of bangs here, probably what the agent is trying to do, or what this protocol will be doing, is going to effectively implement the time average. So if we do that, then we can make the following variational ansatz for an optimal protocol. For example, I can have 3 degrees of freedom corresponding to the 3 pulse lengths. However, we see that this protocol is symmetric, and if this it has a particular symmetry, and if I impose this symmetry, then out of 3 pulses, I essentially gain 2 pulses. So I reduce this to 2 degrees of freedom. And moreover, because I'm also fixing the total duration of the protocol, then it's essentially only a single variable that defines the entire shape. So if I have this, then the question is, what is the optimal value of the variable tau 1 of this pulse duration such that I can optimize a variational fidelity? So this is, you know, we took a solution that came out of the computer, and then we are trying to mimic that solution and see how well we can do. And so what you see here are two curves. There is a blue curve which gives the optimal fidelity of that problem computed with reinforcement learning. And then the dashed line, and the dashed line is this variational fidelity. So you see that they agree fairly well. In particular, this ansatz, simple variational ansatz, works really well for the times where we used it, where we got the inspiration, and then eventually it fails. So then you can ask, well, but what if I look at a later time? Let's say I place myself somewhere here. Then the protocol looks much more complicated, but it's not ridiculously more complicated. So there is still some high-level structure here, and the high-level structure in that case looks like this. And in particular, there's now two independent pulse durations, tau 1 and tau 2.
Sorry, it's still an episodic reward, but you change the definition of the episode? What do you mean looking at that time?
No, what I mean, okay, so what I mean here is that to get the reinforcement learning, so reinforcement learning gives me the blue curve here, right? Now, this variational ansatz that I do has nothing to do with reinforcement learning, right? So here, what I do is I make an ansatz for a protocol that has three pulses, right? It has basically only one degree of freedom, this tau 1. And then I can compute numerically the fidelity because it's a low-dimensional optimization problem, right? And I can find the optimal fidelity within this family, within this ansatz. And this is what gives me the dashed line. Okay? Great. And then I can look at later times, because I see that this eventually fails at later times. I can look into how the actual protocol from the agent looks like. And then this is, of course, all these banks here, they're very complicated, and it turns out actually that they're important to get close to optimality. This is related to the glassiness of the landscape. But in principle, I can ignore all of this, and I can just replace this complicated mess by zero. And however, you see that now I have a second pulse here. And the second pulse means that I have two degrees of freedom, two variational degrees of freedom. So now I can,
No, just a question about the dashed line.
Yes.
Is it optimized at every t?
Yes, at every capital T, yes. Yes, but now I can play the same game with this slightly more complicated two-dimensional variational ansatz.
Is there only one sequence that produces the blue line?
So the blue line is produced by this procedure that I explained on the previous slides.
Right, but if I...
You run it many episodes, right? And then you take the final one.
Right, but if I make some sort of change in the procedure, can I get another just a blue line, but it's a different sequence?
Yes. You're right. You're asking like, are you guaranteed to always find this sequence if you run your algorithm?
How special is the blue line, right?
So okay. So the answer to the first question is no. You're not guaranteed to always find the same protocol because these are essentially different local minima that are close by.
Right.
What I can also say is that the different protocols that your agent gets stuck in.
Yes.
Are going to give you fidelity that you cannot distinguish by bare eye on a linear scale.
Yes. Right.
Yes.
But the sequence
is going to be, yeah, so you can see that this one is special because it's nice and symmetric, right?
Yes.
But of course you can see that if this pulse is not exactly here but a little bit to the left, it's a small time step, so it's not going to make too much of a difference in the fidelity.
And our green ones, in some sense, just coarse-grained versions?
Yes, this is essentially the idea, yes. So we look at what the computer is doing, and then we're trying to mimic it in some coarse-grained way.
Right. So why not just coarse-grained?
That's essentially the same.
Okay. Actually, that would be my question as well. It seems like protocols with three settings on the field would be a lot better, right?
Right. Okay. And yes, but
do people know that? Do people use that? Because I thought they always use.
I don't know if people usually don't use that. So it's actually an important question that you ask. So let me put it this way: for bang-bang protocols, there is a theorem in mathematics which is called Pontryagin's maximum principle, which tells you that if I find a protocol that gives me a given fidelity, then there exists a bang-bang sequence that has at least the same fidelity. This is the first thing to say. However, this theorem has conditions to satisfy to see whether it's applicable. And it turns out that if your control couples like this, which in the control community for some reason is called quadratic coupling, I guess because you have 2 degrees of freedom here. If you have this kind of coupling, then there might be cases, a so-called singular control, where the action of not doing anything becomes actually important. So when we started doing this problem in the beginning, we're only using like these two actions, so plus and minus 4. In the second example that I'm going to show, I'm actually going to add the third action just because of this reason. Yes, but it turns out that for the second example, it wasn't that that illuminating or important. Anyway, other questions?
Well, maybe one.
Yeah.
Can you so here you so chose a set of actions that can lead you to the target state?
No, we don't know that.
Well, on the example you're plotting,
The example that I'm plotting, I get to somewhere close to 1.0. It's actually not 1.0. It's somewhere close to.
Okay, but very close to. But so close to one, or close to the target state. But can you give us some intuition about when this is true? Like, do you have an intuition? Because I think there might be some sense of action that, like,
of course, yes. So there, yes. So this is a whole field of study, and it's basically trying to answer the question, given a Hamiltonian. A control Hamiltonian, first of all, can I get to a given state? And then second, if I can get there, what is the minimum time required to get there? So the minimum time required to get there is known as the quantum speed limit, and there's various studies on how that happens. There's much less studies on what kind of Hamiltonians I need in order to get to these states. Because there are states in the Hilbert space which are inaccessible. Yes, but I cannot give a much more precise answer.
Wait, but if you have a universal set of gates, for example,
no, but this is yes, but this is not physical. I mean, nobody has a universal set of gates.
Wait, I mean, if you have Clifford gates, and
no,
gates,
they exist in theory, but nobody realized them yet. That's what I mean.
In which sense, realized in an experiment? Or
yes. You cannot, because it essentially means that you solve the problem of quantum computing.
I thought this work is in a sense to make these gates, or could be used to make these
You can
gates.
Interpret it in this way. I don't try to sell it in this light, but you could interpret it in this way. Yes, I mean...
The problem of quantum computing is not just... I mean, the IBM thing, they have a universal set of gates. It's just that, I mean, they're noisy, and then you cannot show that... the thing that you've built is really
right.
What you're expecting, but
right.
That's a different. I mean, you can definitely build T gates and.
Well, the number of gates can be exponential, but in principle, you can get to this.
I don't want to go into these guys because this is a problem for a different program. So let me just comment that in that case we see that the agreement actually. Becomes much, much better until, again, later times, and at much later times, it's crappy again. And you can try to kind of play this game, but what's really remarkable here is that you take a quantum chaotic many-body system, and then you can control a quantum chaotic many-body system by a handful of degrees of freedom to a fairly good precision. This precision is not going to be good for quantum computing because there is enough loss here that you won't be able to do reasonable quantum computation with it. But it's good enough for the purposes of the task that I defined here.
Can you tell us what the sort of the numbers are for the minimizing taus on the scale? Right?
So you're asking how big are the taus?
Relative to
right. So here are these are the best taus, that is the maximum taus as a function of the duration. So you see they're on the order of like one, all of them. It's not crazy.
And the duration is a few.
And the duration is a few, yeah.
Okay.
So it's not crazy. In fact, here, if you look at the durations, you find like cool things like these kinks, and sometimes you see other non-analyticities. So this is all related to a phenomenon which is like a transition, like a phase transition in this controlled landscape.
Yes.
And this is something that we actually discussed in that paper, but it's not immediately related to reinforcement learning, even though we found it with the help of reinforcement learning. It does not require reinforcement learning, and therefore it's a subject of a different talk. But I can tell you more about it afterwards, and other people if they're interested.
And how tough is to find tau best?
Here it's not tough at all. It's a two-dimensional optimization problem. There's nothing tough.
So essentially instantaneous.
Depends on many things. I don't know what you mean by instantaneous, but...
Well, I guess I mean the reinforcement learning.
It's not a hard problem. It's much. It's much, much. This is much, much faster than the reinforcement learning procedure. Yes, that's definitely true compared to that. Okay. 15 minutes, I guess. Example number two, which is this again, similar application of RL. So again, I want to prepare states in a quantum system, but this time the system is a single particle.
Sorry, before we go on to two,
but out of the
going back to example one, is there some sense of why two is good enough in this problem to get you to almost perfect fidelity? Why do you get there with two parameters?
Now, this I don't know. This I have no idea.
Well, I mean, this is, right, a very interesting question.
It is, but it's a problem where I cannot do much analytically.
No, I'm not saying
I completely agree. Yeah, it's non-trivial at all.
With 3, 4, or 5, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was a big surprise. I mean, Anatoly lost a bet that this is possible in the first place. And, you know, that it's actually possible by simple means. It's not trivial. Yes?
But so coming back to my previous question, so the conclusion of this example is don't use reinforcement learning, just use optimal control, right? For this particular example.
Yes, you could use just optimal control for this particular example. Yeah. I actually think that for many of the examples, you could use optimal control on the same footing as reinforcement learning.
I mean, what you mentioned sounds very reasonable, but once you kind of, for example, once you transfer learning,
you're pushing towards.
You don't have a model, right?
But you're pushing towards this. So let me just give you the comparison of the two, because I think, you're excited about it. So let me tell you, you know, how does reinforcement learning compare to optimal control, and where the differences are, and where the similarities are, and then we go back to the second example. So the thing is that they're really not that different. So if you really think of reinforcement learning and optimal control, then they're the same size, they're basically different sides of the same metal. So if you open up any book on reinforcement learning, well, almost any, it's actually going to talk about optimal control as well. And if you look into like computer scientists who do research in reinforcement learning, all of them also do research on optimal control. So the two things are really interrelated. The thing is that they were developed historically coming from different directions, coming from different ideas. So optimal control, which is what physicists are more familiar with, comes from a variational calculus. It comes from a cost function, and then you vary this cost function with respect to your controls, right? And then you get a Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation that you solve. So this is what gives you optimal control. Reinforcement learning started in behavioral psychology, and the foundations of reinforcement learning are Markov decision processes, as I showed them on the one of the previous slides. So there, it's really taking decisions, so coming up with a solution sequentially, in a sequence of those decisions. Now, that said, this was like 50 years ago. Nowadays, modern control theory has RL and OC on the same footing. So when I talk about policies, I can talk about policy in both optimal control and reinforcement learning. And it's true that in some cases, I have a model for the environment, and then using optimal control is going to be advantageous, whereas in other cases, I don't have a model of the environment, and then the only thing you could do is use reinforcement learning. There are other subtleties there. For example, if your cost function is non-differentiable, right, then optimal control is going to have a hard time optimizing this landscape with a non-differentiable cost function, whereas reinforcement learning will still be able to do so. And there is also like people have come up like with lists of how that works. But essentially, because of some technical reasons, that is to say, you require a lot of data, it's essentially a machine learning algorithm, RL didn't pick up 50 years ago, but it's only picking up now, because now you have this representational power through deep learning. But you can essentially build in the representational power of deep learning into optimal control as well, and people have done this. So, you know, it's literally, at least the way I think about it, is the two sides of the same metal. So thinking of them as two different things, I don't think you can.
Yeah, my question was much simpler, is that for that particular example, right, I mean, if you compare the times, right, you need essentially to solve the same problem.
Yes.
Like just solving optimal control or whatever you...
Okay, but this is a little bit tricky because in reinforcement learning, in optimal control, what you would do is you would maybe run the algorithm multiple times and then you would do some post selection in the end. In reinforcement learning, you don't do post selection, but you still have multiple episodes in which it is learning. So one has to be a little bit careful how exactly this is compared. One way to compare them would be through the number of fidelity evaluations, cost function evaluations, or something like this. But one has to be a little bit careful how to compare optimal control with reinforcement learning. I can and I will show you after I go through the second example the comparison for two optimal control algorithms and reinforcement learning on the qubit example that we did. Just to finish that slide, right, so in optimal control, we need the model for the environment to express a cost function in. It is best suited for deterministic environments, although it is possible to use optimal control for non-deterministic, that is chaotic, non-deterministic environments. It is advantageous, so whenever you guys have a differentiable cost function, then optimal control can help you. And in particular, if you're able to analytically compute the gradient of the cost function, then optimal control is going to be much, much faster than reinforcement learning. However, if you have no model for the environment, and you want an algorithm which is adaptive and autonomous, then you can use reinforcement learning. If I train reinforcement learning on my system, and then, for example, I change a little bit my model, then I'm sure that optimal control in really the hard optimization problems will take much longer than reinforcement learning to readapt. Then if you have stochastic or uncertain environments, then reinforcement learning typically does better. As I said, the reward function can be discontinuous. And of course, okay, there is this effective degrees of freedom that it finds, but once you found them, then you know it's a matter of, you know, it doesn't matter which algorithm you use to find them, then once they're there, then you have them. Happy? Okay, no, I want to make sure that everybody's happy. Okay, now, the second example. The second example is this Kapitsa oscillator. So now we have a system which is a single particle quantum system, but it will be a system that is intrinsically driven away from equilibrium, periodically driven. And then the idea would be to control it on top of this periodic drive. So just to show you what this system looks like, or at least the classical version of that system. So you see here a pendulum, which has a stable equilibrium point and an unstable equilibrium, just a boring pendulum, right? Mechanics 101, nothing interesting here. Now what this guy's going to do is going to start, let me crank up the volume, he's going to start periodically driving the pivot point vertically very quickly, and through this periodic driving, he stabilizes the inverted position, and not only is it stable, but it's also stable to external perturbations. You can try to perturb it, and it's still going to remain there, right? But notice how this guy actually prepared the state. So this guy gave a small kick to the pendulum on the left so that it was able to get there. And also the dynamics is not completely irregular, right? So the oscillation was a little bit kind of weird. But it's only due to the periodic drive. So if the drive is off, then the pendulum becomes boring again. So now the idea here is to try and figure out how one can use reinforcement learning to control non-equilibrium, intrinsically non-equilibrium systems from one state, coming from one state and going to another state. Now this is an interesting effect, but I had a slide to explain how it goes, but I think I want to skip that slide because I don't have enough time, and I want to go right away to the definition of the control problem. So what I have here is I have a Hamiltonian, which is the free pendulum, the periodic drive, which has nothing to do with the control, right? And then on top, I have the control part of the Hamiltonian. And this time, the control is going to couple to the sine of the angle, so the pendulum is going to have an angle, right, which is going to define the position of it. So now the control is going to be giving kicks to the pendulum left and right. Or, in that case, and for the reasons that we just discussed, I also allow the agent to not do anything. That is, I have like this zero action. So this time there are three actions in the game. As an initial state, I choose the ground state of the non-driven uncontrolled system, which you can solve numerically, and in a Hilbert space of 21 sides, you can plot, it looks like this harmonic oscillator ground state. The target state is the eigenstate of an object which is known as a Floquet Hamiltonian, but you don't really need to know what this guy is. All you care about is this state because I'm giving you that state, and that state, as shown in the previous movie, is going to be localized at the inverted position. And there are some leftover, some small leftover. So now the idea is to start from that initial state, and similar as before, by constructing these pulse sequences, to ask the agent, is it possible for a fixed amount of time to prepare the state, and if it's possible, what's the optimal fidelity one can get, and so forth. The difference to what I did before, because I don't just want to repeat the same thing, is I'm going to try to load the problem a little bit and make it a little bit as close as possible to a real experiment. Although I never done experiments, so it's hard. One thing I want to mention here is that so there are these control bands, but I choose them to be commensurate with the driving period. So I always have a fixed number of bands of steps within one period, right? Even though I'm going to control for more than one periods. Okay, so how do I cook up a simulation of a quantum experiment now? So remember, there was this problem that we don't have access to the quantum states, but then we kind of figured out how to deal with that problem. So instead of learning from the quantum states, we kind of try to learn from the protocol sequences themselves. And what does this mean if you think of reinforcement learning in terms of playing video games? What this essentially means is that you're trying to play your video game without actually looking at the screen. So imagine that you're trying to learn how to play an Atari video game, for example. You're not allowed to see the screen. All you're allowed to see is the score of the game, right? So, and moreover, when the game is over. So it's a little bit hard to do that, but it's not impossible, turns out. Now, let me try to make this a little bit more like a real experiment. So in a real experiment, the cost function is not, you know, this expectation value, but it's really a binary measurement in that case. So, for example, I can model my measurement by the following way. So it's going to be plus one with the probability given by this overlap squared if I'm in the target state, right? And it's going to be minus one otherwise. So at every now episode, instead of giving the exact expectation value, I'm going to give a binary output, minus one or plus one. And now the agent is supposed to figure out essentially the statistics of that on the fly. The third thing I'm going to add to the game is uncertainty. So if I'm an experimentalist, then I can never prepare the same quantum state again. So there's going to be a little bit of uncertainty in the initial state. So this is something that goes into the game. Additionally, if I have a not so perfect control apparatus, maybe, you know, sometimes my banks are going to fail. They're not going to be exactly what I want them to be. So, and this can happen randomly. So there's randomness now in the environment. And on top of this, there's all the problems of how to actually control periodically driven systems. And this is a research problem on its own that, you know, even without like this, this stuff would be there as well. So, you know, I cooked up a problem for you. And now I want to see how well the agent can deal with it. So let's just give this game a try to try and give you a little bit of a flavor of what is happening there. So suppose now that this is my protocol that I want to try. So I don't know anything about the system. I can choose a protocol. I choose this protocol. And then I, you know, do the measurement. My reward happens to be minus one, right? It's a binary output. It can be anything. And then I choose a different protocol, and I get a different reward this time. It's plus one, but it could have been minus one. It doesn't matter. But then I realize something. I say, wait a minute. You know, if I use a different protocol, then it means that I end up in a different final state. But if I end up in a different final state, then the probability from which I draw these numbers changes. So this is a complication, right? I mean, I have a running probability distribution that I'm sampling, right? So this is kind of tricky. So let me just repeat the same protocol instead. And, you know, if I repeat the same protocol, then I expect that, you know, just by counting the, you know, the ratio of the positive to the negative numbers, I can get the probability distribution. So, you know, we need to learn how to do this from noisy and non-deterministic environments. So let's get rid of this quantumness for a second in the reward and see what's going to happen. So now I repeat the same protocol. I get rid of the quantumness. This is essentially equivalent to having an ensemble of systems that I control at the same time, right? Actually, infinitely many, and then I can get the expectation value right away. So when I do this, then I still don't find the same expectation value. So you wonder, you know, what's going on this time? Well, the initial state couldn't be prepared exactly perfectly because I didn't start from the same initial state. I didn't end up in the same final state as, you know, like in the previous time. So there's a little bit of a fluctuation here still. So let's fix the initial state. If I fix the initial state, then I still don't find the right numbers. And this time what happened is that my agent ordered, you know, the control to be positive here. But it didn't happen because sometimes, you know, controls are faulty and there are mistakes. So the control apparatus failed in this case. The problem with with the reality is that all of these things, and probably many more, happen at the same time. They happen simultaneously in a given physical system. Moreover, even if I can build an experiment for this Kapitza oscillator, if somebody else builds an experiment which relies on a different platform, different experimental platform, then the details of these different platforms are going to suggest different noises and different uncertainties. So what we really want is we want to be able to deal with a tedious task in an efficient way and possibly to be able to automate it. And this is something that I guess can be done also with optimal control, but it also can be done with reinforcement learning. And that's the last slide I want to show you. So this is like this video of how the agent gets as close as it can to the state. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to choose 15 driving cycles. So there's 15 periods, if you wish. There's a total of 120 steps. So the total number of protocol configurations, complete protocol configurations, is about 10 to the 57. So it's a huge, huge number. But nonetheless, it's going to be possible. So what you see here is my representation of the quantum oscillator. So it's hard to plot the wave function. So what you see is essentially a ring, and on that ring you see the value of the real space probability distribution of the instantaneous wave function. So I have a wave function that describes my system, and I know that the real space basis, which is this angle basis, is a basis where I can expect to visualize my system. So what I do is initially I start from a state which is localized at theta equals zero, right? So this is where the color bar shows me where the state is localized, and what I want is I want to end up in a state that is localized mostly at the inverted position. And I'm only going to show you the final protocol here. So the kick's duration, the kick direction, this is where, this is essentially kind of a pictorial representation of the protocol as the drive is on. You can see how the agent is trying to move the state from the left, but it's not possible to get there from the left. At least it's not finding a solution from there. And then it eventually succeeds from the right. In the end, what we're going to get is not a perfect fidelity. We're going to get a fidelity of about 0.88 or something like this percent. But as I said, it is not known, 0.898. It is not known, at least to me, what is the best possible fidelity in that case. And this requires further studies. The fact that you can do this in the presence of all this noise, however, I find actually quite appealing and quite interesting. So yes, this we discussed. All right. So I guess this is pretty much it. I'm 4 minutes over time, so I let you ask questions right away.
It's just an observation for the first part. When you were observing that the bang-bang can constrain in a simple way, actually it's okay. To me, it's not exactly the same, because when you constrain, you add the degree of freedom. Because you see that your field can be at zero.
Yes, that's true.
So what you're doing is that you're kind of relaxing your landscape. Instead of using easing variable, you use pots variable.
Yeah.
And then you get something that is much less rough, and the solution is much easier.
Yeah, that's I think that's true.
And I have also another question. Do you know, when you do optimal control, you say that you have, let's say, two flow equations, one that runs onwards in time, and the other one that for the queue that runs backwards in time, right?
Did I say this?
Maybe I got it wrong. So you have the queue of S and A, something like that.
Yes, yes.
That runs, that maybe I just understood not well, that runs backwards in time. Because, I mean, you need to have something that runs backwards in time, because it should tell you what's the reinforcement, what's the reward.
Okay, I see now what you're asking for. So the thing is, yes, so the way that works is, so when you have the agent transitioning from one step to the other, then the agent actually can leave a trace which kind of runs backwards in time.
Yeah.
So there is a trace, and through that trace, it's actually called eligibility trace in reinforcement learning. So through this trace, it can learn information that was seen before, even from previous episodes. So this is how, this is why it's actually possible to give a reward zero throughout the chain and only a reward in the very end. This is how the information propagates.
But do you have like examples when you can solve this in some kind of simple setting?
Yes, you can write down very simple grid world examples where you can actually solve exactly for the optimal Q function, and then you can see how that goes. Yes.
Thanks.
I found interesting the comment on the Atari games. You said like playing this quantum game is like just seeing the score in a standard classical game.
Except the score can be random too.
And do you know of any, if it is possible at all to win at the Atari games by only looking at the score? Do you know whether this has been attempted or not?
I don't think it has been attempted. At least I haven't seen it. Whether it's possible or not, I mean, it's a little bit hard for me to judge the complexity, but the algorithm that they used is the same as the algorithm that we used.
Hang on, lots of reinforcement learning has a very, very long time frame until the reward is actually learned. Is that what you asked?
You mean a time frame, you mean like number of episodes, training episodes?
No, within an episode, like could you take long, long steps? I mean, this is like kind of what they're pushing in the state of the art, right? It's very late, and in
yes.
many games, I mean in Go, you also get a reward after making hundreds of moves, right? So this was not so...
Well, it depends on the... In Go you get it in the end, that's true. But in the Atari games, I think you can get the score right away. So I think it's possible. So this kind of problem, so this is like a big problem also in the computer science RL community to learn from sparse rewards.
I mean, it looks like that from your example, you can do that.
You can do that for, yes, but maybe my example was too simple, right? What I actually want to do is I want to take coupled quantum pendula and see what's going to happen when I couple them.
I think breakout was done this way, actually.
Without
only scores, like the one with the...
Are you sure? Because...
Isn't there randomness in breakout, like the way that...
So in breakout, I know that they use a neural network to pixelize
sure
the...
But I think with reinforcement learning, only the score works for breakout.
Okay, then it is possible. Yeah. I thought that they...
I'm not sure if this stats in the Atari benchmark paper, but I'm pretty sure that they did this. Mm-hmm.
Because what they also did for some of these video games, I'm pretty sure about this, is that they use, so they take the pixels of the screen, and then they feed the pixels of the screen in a convolutional neural network, and then they can try to infer features, basically, what is a good move. Essentially, from the pixels of the screen. But this would be kind of, this won't be what you want, right? You just want to blindly play the game, and apparently it's been done.
But then the question is actually interesting because it remains, what is then the thing that makes reinforcement learning for quantum systems different from classical ones? Because that's not, I don't think that's the one distinguishing factor.
Well, so, I mean, you know, the one thing that is not so common to have like in typical reinforcement learning tasks for classical systems is a non-deterministic reward. So the reward classically is at least going to be deterministic. So I can still have, you know, a stochastic environment. I can still start from a distribution of states initially, but at least what I learn is deterministic. And, you know, this is the only place, if you think about it, like where quantum control and classical control will differ fundamentally, right? Like, the measurement is...
Surely there are examples where the reward itself is...
You can make it. You can make it. I'm not saying that you can't make it. But I'm saying that quantum mechanically, this is kind of a defining feature.
But why are you saying that the quantum reward is non-deterministic? Because if you're computing the fidelity...
Okay, so in the first part, yes, I was computing the fidelity. But in the second part, I was giving these integers plus and minus one. And the thing is, you know, if you have an array of these oscillators in your experiment, right, and then all of them, they are completely decoupled, and then you make them do the same thing with the same protocol, and then you basically measure the fidelity with one sweep, then you can get within some margin, essentially, the total expectation value. This is how some experiments work. But when you have one big many-body system, for example, then you don't have an ensemble of many-body systems that you can get statistics from.
Or you can just repeat.
And then you repeat, exactly. And yeah, so that's the other alternative. But even if you repeat, you're going to have some stochasticity in the reward. Because you can't repeat it infinitely.
Or you can make it as small as you like.
Absolutely, yes.
So coming back to various questions, it looks like that the... well, the fact that you don't have a deterministic reward is not really something like a defining feature of quantum, because it can make as close as you want to the classical case.
I mean, I think, yeah, okay, yeah. You can view it in different ways. I mean, it's, you see, the thing is that you can always find a setup to put it like in the standard framework, right? But in the end, what's I think really going to be giving the bottleneck is your real experimental platform, right? So if you have a real platform, maybe you cannot take like so many measurements before the next move, or maybe it's not going to be optimal, right? Maybe it's going to be optimal to, you know, have like a high uncertainty in the beginning and then try to learn with a larger uncertainty, and then it's going to become better and better, and then you increase. I don't know. So these are like a lot of open questions. What's kind of the best framework? More questions?
Okay, thanks, Mary.